Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad to see that we've got a good turnout today. Clearly, the lecture yesterday by Professor Kahneman has whetted your appetite for more, as it has mine. And I was just reflecting on what he said in the context of some of the policy problems of the national economy. Of course, I know that people here think a great deal about the welfare state, but for most people, of course, the number one policy problem is the national lottery. And after hearing him yesterday, I think I can say that he would be a marvelous person to advise our government on how it could improve the utility derived from the lottery, which of course affects every member of the population. I'm sure that some people here even take a little flutter occasionally. It seems to me that the lottery has done very well by totally turning on its head John Stuart Mill's principle, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. It seems to function perfectly well on the principle of the greatest happiness for the smallest number, and yet people go on putting their money on it. So there must be, I think, a very interesting utility curve there to be drawn. So anyway, Professor Kahneman is going to continue with the second lecture, and let me get the title right. It's Exploring Experienced Utility.
Thank you. I think I would like to move this table a bit.
Yes, okay.
Am I audible? No? Well, you know, everything is on here, but you know, I really don't think that we have a big problem. I'll be perfectly audible without a microphone, I'm quite sure. Now I am audible. Now it is working. All right.
You have to connect to all the panels.
Yes. Am I hiding my transparencies when I speak? I suppose I must be. Let me try not to do that today. I will talk today about two notions of utility. One notion, which I'll call experience utility, is really Bentham's notion. And the idea, Bentham's idea, was to define utility in terms of pleasure and pain. There is that famous first sentence in his book where he talks of the two sovereign masters that determine or govern, I think, what we do and what we should do. Then he has a very strange footnote. Then he calls it utility, and then he has a strange footnote where he apologizes, saying that utility is really not a good word for pleasure and pain, but he couldn't think of a better word. And we have had the word utility ever since. There is a modern sense of utility which is really quite different from what Bentham had in mind. And this is the way that the term is used in decision theory and in economics. And I would like to refer to this today, and I mentioned that yesterday, as decision utility. And this, the decision utility associated with an outcome or with an attribute, is the weight of that outcome or attribute in a decision. Now, experience utility really vanished from economics, and many authors have commented on this disappearance. And it vanished for a number of reasons. One critique, I think, that was raised about the notion of hedonism or experience utility was that experience utility is subjective and therefore not measurable, and that the focus of economics is and probably should be choice, which has the methodological advantage of being observable. Another reason, less often stated, I believe, but still quite important for dismissing any particular concern with outcomes as they are experienced, is that if agents are rational, and agents are assumed to be rational, then we need not be concerned about the quality of their outcomes, because they are concerned with the quality of their outcomes, and presumably they will be able to maximize that quality. In my view, both of these arguments are questionable. I believe that experience utility is measurable to a fair degree, and I'm not sure that we can assume that people are sufficiently rational to maximize the quality of their outcomes. And therefore, there may be some interest, I believe, in exploring experience utility, which is what I'll be doing today. I should put a qualification in place, which I will sound as if, you know, I think that pleasure and pain are the be-all and end-all of human activity. Of course, I do not believe that. There is no implied endorsement of hedonism, but there are a great many activities in which people engage, the goal of which is to improve or maximize the quality of their experience, and there are enough of those, I think, to justify concern with experience utility. In any given situation, the determination of whether experience utility is indeed the outcome or the attribute to be maximized depends on a value judgment. So with that in place, I will now sound for the rest of the talk as if I believed in hedonism. Now, when we try to understand instant utility, experience utility, the building block for that, I believe, is to recognize that pleasure and pain are characteristics primarily of a given moment. That is, I can ask you the question, how are you feeling now? And what you're feeling now could be described in terms of positive or negative affect or pleasure or pain. So it is a characteristic of an instant, like the brightness of a light is a characteristic of an instant. Brightness is an attribute of an instant of time. The loudness of a sound is an attribute of an instant of time. And so I will speak first of instant utility, that is, pleasure or pain measured at a point in time. Now, the content of what gives people experience utility or positive utility varies a great deal, from pure sensory pleasure to the states of absorption and almost ecstasy and intellectual activity that Csikszentmihalyi has described as flow, or from physical pain to anxiety. So I believe that a great many different experiences feed into a positive evaluation that we can call of a given moment that we can call positive experience utility, and a great many aversive states flow into negative utility. There are three basic hedonic states, and that much is quite obvious. There is a state in which we wish things to continue. There is a state that we wish to escape or to interrupt, and there is a state in which we don't care. And it's fairly clear when we look at the biology of pleasure and pain that this description actually carries some weight. What pleasure in particular seems to be designed for, it seems to be designed to encourage ongoing consumption activities that are biologically significant. And so pleasure is something that we experience primarily, I mean primary pleasures, are experienced in the context of consumption, and they really have that character of just ongoing, of encouraging ongoing activity. It's very clear that pain is an interrupt signal, and what derives from pain interrupts ongoing activity. And then there are states that are best described as neutral. It turns out that one can measure instant utility not so badly, and there are various methods to do this. This will sound a little bit incredible. And in part, some of what I will say is science. Some of it is science fiction, but the science fiction is very rapidly becoming science in this domain. This is a field in which very rapid progress is being made. First, it should be noted that we can probably measure experience utility about as well as we can measure subjective brightness. Brightness or loudness or subjective temperature are all qualities of subjective experience, and yet what we ask people questions about it, and we trust their answers, and the reason in part that we trust their answers is that reports of subjective brightness or loudness depend on the physical attributes in very much the same way for different people, so that when you vary the luminance of a light, and people report on the brightness of some illuminated patch, then the reports of people, the numerical reports of people about the intensity of their brightness experience is quite similar for different people. This is what gives us the sense that although the experiences are subjective, there is something that is intersubjective, and that in that sense, the brightness machines that is in our visual system are reasonably uniform. Now, there is some indication that the pleasure machines, to use Edgeworth's term, the pleasure machines that are in our heads are also probably relatively uniform. For example, we can measure the quantitative reports of people about the intensity of pain that they experience when given electric shocks, where you vary the intensity of the shock. The pain of women in labor has been studied, their numerical expressions of, the numbers that they assign to their subjective experience has been studied as a function of the physical intensity of labor contractions. And again, you find fairly regular relationships that are stable within individual and make a fair amount of sense across individuals. We can also measure, and I will depend on that a bit later, we can also measure experience utility by looking at faces. And sometimes, by looking at faces, that's not quite enough. The very sensitive measurements are of what are called micro-expressions, which are actually not visible by the naked eye, but that you can record by recording electrical activity in the face, and that's an area of very rapid development these days. There are also physiological measures, and I'm going very quickly just to tell you that there is a science there that is developing and that I think in a few years a great deal of progress will have been made in that domain. It turns out that the two halves of our brain are not equally happy. The left side of our brain is distinctly happier than the right side, and so it is much advice to anybody who is going to have a stroke to have a stroke on the right side, because those are the people who are cheerful about it. If you have a left stroke, a stroke on the left side, you end up extremely miserable. Now, the asymmetry of activity in the left the prefrontal areas between left and right is a characteristic that is measurable in babies. It is quite stable as a characteristic of people. It varies substantially with circumstances and correlates quite well with mood, so that we can anticipate a time where some unobtrusive measures of the relative activity in the prefrontal areas of right and left can be picked up from people without asking them any questions whatever, and where there might be some ongoing physiological recording of something that is probably quite closely correlated with experience utility. So now, all of that is about instant utility. That is, everything that I have talked about refers to measuring pain or pleasure or positive or negative affect at a given moment of time. But now, the outcomes that we care about are not instants. The outcomes that we care about are extended over time. And I will call them TEO for temporally extended over time. And the real question when we want to evaluate the experience utility of outcomes is going to be, how do we integrate the information about instant utility, which is where instant utility is a characteristic of moments, but outcomes are extended over time. Let me just to introduce the problem, let me give you some examples of the kind of data that I have been collecting for the past 6 or 7 years. These are records of people watching really plotless films, some of them pleasant, some of them quite unpleasant. The x-axis is time. So you have a puppy playing with a flower, and you can see that it starts reasonably pleasant, and after about 2 minutes, this gets fairly boring. Flying over African landscape stays quite nice for over 2 minutes. Killing wild pigs with clubs is not good. Medical film of an amputation is not good at all. And you have a fairly sensitive record of what is going on. There is a lot of agreement between people watching these films in what they record. And there are two versions of this film, and we'll come back. There is a version that is about a third as long as the other versions. Okay, so that's one type. Here is another one, and we'll talk about that other one quite a bit. This is quite different. Those are real patients undergoing a medical procedure called a colonoscopy, which is quite unpleasant when done with relatively little anesthetic. It involves a tube up the gut. What these patients are asked to report is every 60 seconds they are prompted to report the pain that they're experiencing. And those are what I'll call utility profiles. What I'm showing you are utility profiles of a temporally extended experience. So you have patient A and you have patient B, and this is what they recorded. Now, the question that I'm going to be raising and asking you to think about, and the question that I've been thinking about a great deal over the last few years, is who had the worst colonoscopy? patient A or patient B. So we're looking at these records and we're asking who had the worst experience. How are we going to go about deciding this? And I think as we look at this, it seems apparent that patient B had a harder time because patient B seemed to have had all the pain that patient A had and then some. Patient A's colonoscopy was over in 8 minutes or 9 minutes. Patient B went on for 24. And, you know, they had the same peak of pain and so on. But a bit later, you will see, as I describe some of our results, you will be able to predict, as I would be now, that of these two, a patient B is going to be a great deal more satisfied with his or her colonoscopy than patient A. And we'll have to understand why that is the case. Now, in raising that question of who had the worst colonoscopy, I was actually raising a very serious question. And I'd like to now discuss variance of experience utility. Instant utility, as I pointed out, is the building block on which, you know, we're going to operate. Now I'm going to propose, for instant utility, we trust the patient, we trust the subject. So we accept the subject's report or what their brainwaves tell us. This we accept. Now, when it comes to evaluating a period of pain, I suggest that we have excellent reason not to trust the subject because their memory is fallible, because their ability to integrate the information over time turns out to be extremely limited. So we cannot accept people's judgments of their past experiences. We're going almost to be forced to make that judgment ourselves. And so I would like to introduce a notion of total utility of temporally extended experience, and that notion is a normative judgment. That is, we are going to have a look, and as I propose we do with patient A and patient B, we are going to say patient B had the worst colonoscopy, even if patient A thinks worse of his colonoscopy than patient B thinks of his colonoscopy. Remembered utility is the subjective reports of people who actually have had the experience. So the fundamental move that is being made here is not to accept people's reports about past episode, to accept people's reports only of their instant utility. As you will see, this is a move that has very significant consequences. Now, we can make the same move, I propose, not only with respect to utility, but to the utility of episodes, but with respect to the much broader concept of happiness or well-being. And again, I would propose that there is an objective notion of happiness which is based not on looking at people's circumstances, but on looking at their experience utility over time. And that you can, just in the same way that we can make a normatively informed judgment about the utility of an episode, the total utility of an episode, we should be able to make a judgment of whether someone is happy or not on the basis of some type of record of what is going on in their experience over time. And that need not be the same as their subjective judgment of how happy they are. So here again, I'm proposing we should make the same move. We should not necessarily accept subjective judgment beyond the moment. We are dependent on people to tell us their pain or pleasure of the moment. So I've been thinking about those issues for a while, and a couple of years ago, I got together with mainly Peter Walker, who is a quite well-known decision analyst and theorist, and a very good mathematician, to try to do together an analysis of the problem of total utility. And the question that we raised was the following. Given utility profiles, so imagine that you're an observer and you have access to a whole set of utility profiles, say of colonoscopies, but in principle, they need not be of the same experience. If we have a measure of instant utility that travels well across contexts, and we need such a measure, then in principle, any two episodes will do regardless. We want to assess the total utility. We want to develop some rules. There is a basic intuition here, and the intuition is that time must matter. And time must matter because there are really two ways of suffering more. You can suffer more intensely or you can suffer longer. And both of these will make a colonoscopy worse, so that you can take a given colonoscopy and you can make it more intense, or you can keep it the way it was and just extend it. And obviously, in both ways, we have made the colonoscopy worse. So that indicates that there must be a trade-off between time and intensity. The moment you know that there is a trade-off between time and intensity, then you can rescale things. The game is almost over. There must be a way of redefining our quantities so that the total utility of an episode will be the temporal integral of the instant utility recorded at different moments. By the way, Edgeworth has a statement where he obviously anticipated something very much like this. Now, we're going to make some assumptions, and just I'm going to go very briefly over the formal treatment, but I think the assumptions are rather interesting and important to get right. One, when we evaluate utility profiles, I think the whole notion of time of discounting goes out the window. It is of no interest whatever. I mean, we could have a utility profile of, you know, an experience that Julius Caesar had. I mean, the time at which that experience occurred doesn't matter. The perspective, if you will, from which we evaluate total utility is retrospective. It's already happened. We're looking back. And therefore, the rationale for discounting has vanished. We're going to assume that we have an ordinal measure of instant utility. This is already Peter Walker's work, formal work. I would not have been able to do this. And our objectives are to study conditions under which we get integration. More broadly, really, what the exercise that I was very interested in performing was to show that there is a logic to experience utility. That is, there are reasonable ways of assessing episodes, and there are ways of assessing episodes which are not reasonable, and it's a matter of exploring the logic of that, and in some sense create an equivalence, at least, between the experience utility and decision utility. We have a logic for decision utility. Well, it turns out that experience utility has a logic too. That is, thinking about which episodes are worse than which others is an important activity. Furthermore, it is an activity that we engage in. There are intuitions about how it ought to be conducted, and we explore these intuitions. I'm going to go, really, it's just to show you that it can be done. There are three axioms and a theorem. The work is really Peter Walker. Just to give you a sense that the axioms are really quite innocuous. The total utility of a utility profile is not affected by concatenation with a neutral utility profile. This is perhaps not so innocuous. A neutral utility profile is one that is at zero. It's in the don't care state. So you can imagine adding a neutral period to a utility profile. Axiom number one says we're going to assume that adding a neutral period does not affect total utility. That's a fundamental axiom, and you can see that a lot is going to follow from that. Axiom two, increases of instant utility do not decrease the total utility of a utility profile. And axiom three, something about concatenating episodes. The theorem is rather beautiful. I can say that honestly because I've had so little to do with proving it. The three axioms hold if and only if there exists a non-decreasing transformation function of instant utility. Remember, instant utility is ordinal. It doesn't have cardinal properties. Assigning values 0 to 0 such that total utility orders utility profile according to the temporal integral of the integral of instant utility over time. So in short, if judgments of utility profiles, like profiles of colonoscopies, conform to axioms 1, 2, and 3, then there exists a rescaling such that there exists a rescaling of instant utility for which the temporal integration holds. And it's an if and only if. Let me make some observations about this at the more general level at which I can talk competently. The inputs to this analysis might look superficially like discounted utility models, because, you know, it involves time and it involves some effort at integrating a stream of outcomes over time. This is a very different beast than a temporal, than a discounted utility model for the following reason. In discounted utility models, the inputs are actual objects of consumption of some kind. Here, the inputs to the analysis are instant utilities. So we measure the instant utility of moments. That simplifies life enormously, because all the sequential dependency, the changes of tastes, and so on, that complicate life in discounted utility models are absorbed here into, presumably, into the measure of instant utility. So that makes separability conditions plausible. And as I already mentioned, the stance is retrospective, and there is no discounting. So this is fairly straightforward. The measure of instant utility that we need must be sensitive to all the relevant variables. So if our tastes change so that we like something less because of a previous experience, that must be incorporated. If anticipation of a pleasure is pleasurable, that must be incorporated. Everything that we would want to be included in the total utility of an episode must be incorporated in instant utility. I do not know whether we can satisfy this. We certainly do not have an available measure of instant utility of which I could say that it satisfies these conditions. But the task, at least, is well defined. And I believe that having defined the task, there is some chance that further progress will be made. The logic of what we're doing here should, to people who know something about medical decision analysis and about quality-adjusted life years, there is a close resemblance in the problems that arise in measuring, you know, the quality, in adjusting the duration of life, or in substituting duration of life for quality of life. There, as we do here, we are trading time against quality in various ways. So it's a similar issue. What the Peter Walker's theorem allows us to do, it says there is a rescaling of instant utility, you know, if we satisfy those axioms. There is a rescaling such that the total utility of an episode will be the integral of this rescaled instant utility, and objectiveness happiness over a period will simply be the average of that rescaled utility. Notice that the rescaling is essential. That is, you cannot just take what people tell you and take the integral or take the average. You have to make sure that there is some consistency and some normative justification to the trade-offs between time and intensity that allow this to go through. Now, you know, if we were stuck with this, I would say this lecture would be premature. But I think that much, it may be premature even so, but I think that much can be done even without really solving the entire measurement problem. That is, it turns out that there are things that we can understand even before we develop all that needs to be developed for the measurement of total utility and the measurement of objective happiness to become a reality. So much for the normative analysis, for the logic of experience utility. Let me now go on very quickly to the psychology of experience utility. That is, how do people evaluate episodes? What do we know about this? And I would like you to notice that it is a fundamental characteristic of the human brain, really, and the human mind, that there is no perceptual representation of temporal integrals in general. Let me make this notion easier by inviting you to perform a thought experiment. Suppose you are in a psychological laboratory, in a vision laboratory, and you're in a room that is, it doesn't have to be completely dark. There is going to be a patch of light, and on every trial, a patch of light is going to appear. Its brightness is going to fluctuate over time, and its duration is going to vary from trial to trial. So we have somebody who is watching this patch of light as it fluctuates, and can be asked two kinds of questions. How bright is the light now? That's the equivalent of asking the instant utility question. It's a slice through time. We can also ask the individual, how much total brightness did you experience on this trial? And notice that this question does not make sense. we do not have a perceptual representation of the temporal integral of brightness over time. Now, it turns out that we don't have it for many reasons, biologically quite sensible reasons. What people, and for brightness it may not matter. I mean, there are not many needs, you know, that we have to evaluate the temporal integral of brightness. For utility, it does matter, because if we do want to evaluate episodes in a sensible way, what we're really required to do is to evaluate a temporal integral of some kind. And it turns out that our perceptual machinery does not deliver this. What our perceptual machinery delivers is a reading of instant utility, and it does not deliver an integral. So it turns out that what people do when you ask them the total brightness question, I haven't asked it, I've asked the total loudness question. I have exposed people to trials very much as I described it, where there is a sound that varies in loudness over time and varies in duration across trials. And you ask people, what is the total energy contained in the sound? And what they tell you is primarily how loud the sound was. That is, they give you a representative moment when you're asking them for an integral. It turns out people do very much the same thing when you ask them about the remembered utility of an entire episode. So people, there is a general principle, which I think has very deep roots in the human cognition, and which is that we're not equipped to deal with integrals. We're equipped to deal with moments, because this is what perception is about. Perception is about moments. It's about what's going on now. And our memory is attuned to our perception. So we evaluate by representative moments. And then we'll distinguish, and we'll talk about two things, ex ante evaluation, the evaluation of an episode that you anticipate. It turns out, I suggested that yesterday, actually, that the way that we think of states is very often by thinking about the transition to those states. So that's a transition is a moment. And yesterday I was talking of the confusion between changes and states and telling you that changes are used as proxies for states. I'm now returning to that idea. Looking back at a profile of at an experience, when we talk about remembered utility, it turns out that people apparently construct a composite moment that is that is some sort of average of how intense the experience was at its peak, what its value was when the experience ended, and there is some weight to the general trend of the experience toward the end. And with those three factors, it turns out, you can predict the remembered utility that people associate with experiences remarkably well. Remembered utility is very important in our lives. That is, when we have an experience, we apparently lay down a trace of how much we liked that situation or liked that experience. The determination of that we like that experience predisposes us to repeat it. This is what we learn. So remembered utility is what we learn. To the extent that there are errors in remembered utility, there are going to be errors in what we learn from our experiences. People in many situations, as we'll see, choose between different experiences according to the quality of what is stored in their memories about these experiences, those stored evaluations. And so remembered utility controls a lot of our behavior. We've run really a number of experiments on this, and I'm not going to describe all of them, but here is the one I was showing you earlier. Here, every one of our subjects was exposed to 16 films. 8 were pleasant, 8 were unpleasant, 4 were relatively long, and 4 of each were relatively long, 4 of each were relatively short. And then we ran routine regression analyses, trying to figure out how to predict their global evaluations. And in various ways, and we had different measures, and they all turned out quite similar, we attempted to obtain from people the global evaluations of, you know, each of these films, like the amputation film or flying over the landscape and so on. And this is how well you do. Those are regression coefficients. Those are correlations, actually. And there are correlations computed within the data of individual subjects. So those are the means of correlations computed within the data of individual subject. We look at the simple average of the peak and the end, and it predicts the global evaluation quite remarkably well, I think. Duration is relatively a weak predictor. Now notice that there is a statistical artifact built into this analysis in that duration and the peak of the experience are necessarily correlated. That is, the peak can never go down as you make an when you make an experience longer. When you correct for that artifact, we get what we call complete duration neglect. That is, people are insensitive to the duration of the experience. And this insensitivity to the duration of the experience is quite a robust result. Here is the colonoscopy again. And let me show you some results of the colonoscopy. And I'm going to dwell on several features of this. Here, we have each patient only has one colonoscopy, so the correlations that we compute are over subjects. So we are here crossing into the domain of interpersonal comparisons because we're simply treating all individuals alike. We're ignoring the differences between individuals. What we do is for each subject, we obtain the average of the peak and the end. We know the durations of the colonoscopy. They vary enormously. In this particular study, the shortest colonoscopy was, I think, 4 minutes, and the longest one was 69 minutes. And the mean was over 20 with standard deviation of close to 15. So we have a big spread of duration. Duration just is not a factor, essentially. It is not a significant factor in people's judgments. The physicians, by the way, judge the colonoscopy. They were also asked to evaluate the patient's colonoscopy, and they are very similar to the patients themselves. They follow the same rule. There is a worrying aspect about the physician's behavior that I'd like to mention. We asked the physicians, after the colonoscopy was over, should you have given more anesthetic? And there is one variable that just doesn't predict that at all, and this is how long the colonoscopy was, how intense the pain was, and the physician did not have access to the computer. The physician was looking at the patient wincing. The intensity of the subject's pain, or the patient's pain, did predict what the physician said. The duration, they simply did not seem to care about the duration in evaluating the patient's pain. There is another aspect that I'd like to mention. For a subsample here, I think 50 patients, as I recall, we did not ask these patients to provide a recording of instant utility. So we did not ask them anything. But my collaborator's nurse, actually his secretary, his secretary or research assistant was in the room, and every 60 seconds, watching the patient's face, she recorded what she believed to be the patient's pain at that moment. And this is this correlation. She was doing just as well as the patients themselves. That is, the peak of what she recorded and the end of what she recorded predicted the remembered utility of those colonoscopies extremely well. Notice what seems not to be a problem here is interpersonal comparison of utility. You know, this is supposed to be a completely intractable problem. In fact, at some level, it is completely intractable. But if you sort of ignore it and march ahead, it turns out that you can do very well ignoring it, and you do not lose a lot in the quality of data by ignoring that problem. This would not come as a surprise, actually, to psychologists who study brightness or loudness or other functions. It does come as a surprise to many philosophers. Here is a situation where people choose the wrong thing, and we have run several of those experiments. What happens in this experiment is that our subjects are brought in and they are told this is an experiment about pain and you will have, you will be made to suffer a bit. Actually, we are quite mild in, you know, in the pain that we inflict. And, you know, they give what informed consent to have their hand in quite cold water, water that is painfully cold, although not agonizingly cold. Then they actually have, they are told that they are going to have three trials. In fact, they only have two. One of them is short, and it's 60 seconds at 14 degrees Celsius. The long trial, which they have either 7 minutes earlier or 7 minutes later, the long trial is 60 seconds at 14 Celsius, followed by 30 seconds in which, unbeknownst to the subject, the temperature of the water is gradually raised to 15 degrees. Then they have another 7 minutes, then they're brought back into the lab, and then they're asked the question, they're told, well, you had two experiences, we're going to repeat exactly what was done to you in one of these experiences, and you may choose what was done to you on the left hand or on the right hand. And so which of these two experiences would you rather repeat? And there is really quite a stable result. We have between two-thirds and three-quarters of subjects prefer to repeat the long exposure. They opt to expose themselves willingly to more pain rather than less pain. The reason is fairly obvious in terms of the theory that I've proposed. It's obvious after the fact. This is also the same reason why patient A, although who had a colonoscopy of 8 minutes, liked it less than patient, disliked it more than patient B. For patient A, the experience ended at its peak, so that the peak and the end were both bad. For patient B, and for the people exposed to the, and in the long trial of this experiment, the peak is just as bad, but the end is better. If people average the peak and the end, they're going to like the long experience more than the short one, and this is what, by and large, they do. When you use measures of instant utility to improve the quality of the data, the preference for the long over the short exposure goes to over 80%. We have replicated that with loud sounds. We're really very sure of this result. So people will remember utility can mislead you and can cause you to pick something that you actually will not like. What is happening here is that people choose what they like. That is, when I ask you which of these two experiences would you like to repeat, you do the same thing as you do when you choose a dish in a restaurant. You remember how much you like it. So the experience laid a trace. The trace comes with a value. It comes evaluated. And this is what guides our action. We've put that to some use by running an experiment that is philosophically interesting. We have obtained human subject approval to prolong people's colonoscopies and make them have a better memory. So that the way that this is done is that on a completely randomized basis, the physician who finds, you know, who comes to perform a colonoscopy has an envelope, and on the envelope it says standard procedure, experimental procedure. The standard is just a routine colonoscopy. In the experimental procedure, when the colonoscopy is effectively ended, the physician leaves the tube in for a while. Now, this is not particularly pleasant, and nobody would really choose to have the tube left in. But when the tube is not moving, the level of pain is lower, and for many patients, quite a few patients, substantially lower than it was as the colonoscopy would normally have ended. And it turns out that there's a, you know, quite substantial, I'm not sure it's practically valuable, but there is certainly a highly significant difference in the overall attitude of people to their colonoscopy. This procedure, which nobody would agree to, that is, I do not think that people would willingly agree to expose themselves to more pain in order to have a slightly better memory. But if they had two colonoscopies with two physicians who treated them in these two ways, they would pick the physician who extended their colonoscopy. So, what are the implications? Well, there is here, I believe, a challenge to experience utility. There is a challenge to substantive rationality. We find decisions that do not maximize experience utility. And so in that sense, you know, it is often argued that maximization of utility is a tautology. No, it's not a tautology. In this context, it is false. That is, we can falsify this as a hypothesis that people will make decisions that will maximize their experience utility. Now, there is an interesting question about what people may learn from experience to maximize. And the argument that I'd like to make is, I've made it I've hinted at it before, is that people really learn to maximize their remembered utility because this is all they retain. So that we could imagine people who go through life basically trying to improve the quality, to have experiences that will leave good memories, even if the experiences themselves are not so wonderful. And that raises quite an interesting normative question. And the question is, who is the relevant self? That is, what would you want to do? What would you want? How would you want to live? How would you want a baby to have experiences? If you were making decisions for someone else, would you make decisions so as to maximize the utility, or so as the actual total utility, or as to maximize the remembered utility when the two diverge? And I think that they quite often diverge. And this mode of analysis raises quite similar doubts about subjective happiness relative to objective happiness. And this won't take me very long, to talk a bit about people's ability to predict their future utility. And in part, I've spoken of one way of predicting future utility, which is if you are repeating an experience, then you're just predicting that it will be like it was. But suppose you are going to have a new experience. What are the rules that people apply in predicting? And we ran a number of experiments. This is, I think, becoming an interesting topic. The experiment that we ran on this involved people coming to the laboratory to consume ice cream. And so we advertised. We had many, many willing subjects for this. We paid them. They came, and on the first day, they informed us of what their favorite ice cream flavor was. And we arranged for them to come back to the laboratory on 7 consecutive working days to have the same experience at the same hour of the day. And the experience was to have a normal helping of their favorite ice cream while listening to a piece of music, which I happened to choose, a piece of Canadian rock, which I liked at the time. And that was the experience. So they had the experience on day one, and they knew they were going to have it 7 more times. And at the end of the experience on day one, we asked them to predict how they would rate the various aspects of the experience on the next day and on the final day. And there are lots of changes that happen. Some people become mildly addicted to the ice cream. Many people get quite bored with it. There is a fair amount of variance. The interesting point is that people have no idea what's going to happen to them. The correlation between the changes they predict and the changes that actually occur in their taste over those 8 days is, to a very good first approximation, 0. And we replicated that experiment, that result, with other experiences, with plain low-fat yogurt, which people start out disliking, and then many people, to their surprise, after 8 days of it, they quite like it. and so the people really are not terribly good judges of their own pleasure machines. This, I think, given the role of predicted tastes in some important economic theories, is an interesting result. People are unable to predict their choices, even short-term. Yesterday, I described an experiment involving a mug that sellers value much more than choosers. It turns out that if you put a mug in front of people and you tell them, imagine that you had that mug, how much would you sell it for? They can't predict that. They cannot predict the effect that it will have on them, just having that mug and having to give it back. And so that the endowment effect is not predicted by people, and there are other results of the same kind. The inability to predict future utility extends to long-term happiness. And the long-term classic of well-being research, really the jewel of well-being research, is by... Actually, it's not Brickman and Campbell. That's my error. It's Brickman and several collaborators who studied paraplegics and lottery winners. And they study the well-being of paraplegics and lottery winners. And the long and the short of it is that everyone who reads the study is astonished. And you're astonished that the paraplegics are not very, very happy people, but they are not as miserable as you would have thought. And the lottery winners are certainly not as happy as you would have thought. It turns out that there is considerable adaptation to maintain states. so that paraplegics adapt and lottery winners adapt and people who become richer adapt in various ways. And when there are secular trends in income, people adapt to those, and people adapt to old age, and they adapt to losing their hair. And there is a great deal of adaptation going on. And people do not predict that very well. Just a couple of weeks ago, last week, in fact, we finished an experiment, very simple experiment, where we asked students questions about paraplegics. And one of the questions was, what percentage of the time is a paraplegic in a good mood or in a bad mood? You know, and we described who the paraplegic was, gave some details about age, and so on. And the key variable is, then we asked these people another question. Do you know a paraplegic? This is what happens. If you do not know a paraplegic, you think that paraplegics are 43% of the time in a bad mood and 20% in a good mood. If you know a paraplegic, those are the results. We call that a focusing illusion. And it's, I think, quite important. You ask yourself, what is it like to be a paraplegic? And you think as if a paraplegic was a paraplegic full time. But paraplegia is not full time. That is, the paraplegic thinks of many other things, enjoys food, enjoys gossip. A lot of other things happen besides the experiences that are specifically connected to being a paraplegic. Here's another experiment that David Shkade and I, David Shkade was also involved in the paraplegic study. Does living in California make people happy? The question arose actually in the context of global warming. I was involved in some conversation. People wanted to do some social science on global warming and, you know, how do we measure the disutility of global warming? And I said, how can you tell? I mean, we don't even know what... how could you tell what it would be like to live in a world after global warming? We don't even know what it's like to live in California. So I immediately got a lot of money, actually, to study what people know about what it's like to live in California. The long and short of it is quite straightforward. If you take populations of students in California and in the Midwest and you administer a well-being questionnaire to them, they're identical virtually to the second decimal, their self-reported life satisfaction. People in California love their climate. People in the Midwest hate their climate. Climate just isn't very important to happiness. However, everybody agrees that Californians are happier. This is true for people in the Midwest. They think that Californians are a lot happier than they are. It's also true for people in California. They can't imagine how miserable people in the Midwest are. And none of this is based in reality. What is happening here? Well, Shkade and I have proposed this notion of a focusing illusion, and let me tell you a bit about focusing illusion. What happens to a paraplegic, and probably what happens to people, well, I know, you know, I've lived in California, and I now live in Princeton, and which doesn't have the same climate at all. When you move to, say, some areas in California, which are gloriously beautiful and the climate is marvelous, you pay a lot of attention to that initially. But your allocation of attention changes over time. But when you're asked to judge what it is like to be a paraplegic or to live in California, or if you're in California, to live in Ohio, then you focus on that characteristic and then you exaggerate its weight. Then there is another process that we talked about, which is that changes are a proxy for states. And we have a lot of evidence for that that I won't have time to go over. But it looks as if when people think of being a paraplegic, they really think of becoming a paraplegic. And it's the transition, the tragedy of the transition, which is undoubtedly there, that people respond to very strongly. What they tend to neglect is the process of adaptation that will take later, that will take place later and will change the overall evaluation. We end up with something, you know, everybody would like to have a law named after him. If there were a Kahneman law, I would maybe like to pick this one. Whenever you focus on an aspect of life, you exaggerate its importance. And that seems just to be built in to this problem of allocating or reallocating attention. There is an instructive exception, by the way, which is noise, like highway noise. It turns out that noise is something that people believe they will adapt to, but in fact they don't, or they adapt much less well than they would have thought. There are many physiological indications of chronic stress associated with high level of ambient noise in children as well as in adults. What seems to be happening is that here people have an experience of not paying attention to noise. And they know they don't pay attention. What they do not realize is that there is a lot of stress going on in not paying attention. And that's, so in fact, that exception, I think, does not invalidate the rule. Here is the last result I'm going to show you. Here is a focusing illusion on judgments of happiness. Subjective happiness, I think, may not reflect objective happiness at all for the reasons that, you know, must be obvious. And it's susceptible to a focusing illusion. And a very elegant experiment was done on this by Strack and Schwartz and others, where they asked American students, I don't think it would be very different anywhere, two questions. How happy are you? And how many dates did you have last month? Now, and then they looked at the correlation between these two questions. And the correlation depends entirely on the order in which the two questions are asked. If you ask the two questions in this order, the correlation is 0.12. If you ask the questions in the other order, how many dates did you have last month and how happy are you, the correlation goes up to 0.66. Now, there are many, many important lessons to be learned from this experiment. One of them, obviously, is that people do not know how happy they are. The judgment of happiness is one of those judgments that we compute on the fly. We do not have it stored. We are asked. We compute it. We compute it in context. And when you present that context, you can redefine what happiness is transiently so that it becomes very dependent on dating or on any other aspect of life. This has now been replicated in a wide variety of ways. Let me... I'm at the point of summarizing. I'd like to draw a few implications from what I have said. One, I'd like to point out that there is an aspect of the case against paternalism that should be questioned. Paternalism, when people argue against paternalism, and economists certainly argue against paternalism quite a bit, there are two major arguments. One is that people know what's good for them. They certainly know better than the government does and so on. And there is another argument, which is that freedom is a value in itself. I think that the kind of evidence that is accumulating here says that the first argument is weak. If we're going to reject paternalism, we'd better do it on the second. It's not because people necessarily know what's good for them, and I could even imagine situations in which physicians would know what's good for patients better than patients do. I don't know about the government, but certainly physicians. There are some implications of what's been said for the definition of the good life. In the first place, I think I'm suggesting that this is an empirical question that we can study. That is, with those, we could study the circumstances that produce objective happiness. In general, my guess is that the standard social criticism against consuming durables and in favor of living life as a series of pleasures, or inducing more pleasures and fewer comforts. If you know Skitovsky's book, The Joyless Economy, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, I strongly recommend have a look at it. It's a very interesting book. It's going to be a book by Robert Frank appearing on well-being and consumption, which I strongly recommend, and which draws in a very sophisticated way on psychological arguments to make the point that it is simply not the case that people control their consumption so as to maximize their experience utility. So the idea that people know how to consume, they may not. And the whole point of Skitovsky's book was that people are not very skilled at living a good life. Skitovsky had a further argument. He's a Hungarian living in the United States. He thought the Americans have no idea how to live. Hungarians are much better at it. There is a research agenda, and this is my last slide. I have proposed a broader view of utility. And I'm proposing that we need not be stuck with decision utility as our only way of thinking about utility. There may be new measures and there may be new applications, and it, for some context, probably especially the context of welfare economics, we might actually be better off not focusing exclusively on choices, but on measures of the quality of experience. I've argued that maximizing utility is an empirical issue. People undoubtedly sometimes maximize. We ought to focus on the question of where and why do they maximize and how do they fail. And I would like to argue that the constancy of tastes is an empirical issue. As you know, many of you know that this is very important, say, in the doctrine of in Gary Becker's treatment of things. I think the idea that people know what their tastes will be really flies in the face of the evidence. People are not very good at predicting their utility, and their tastes do change. The one thing that may not change is that people like pleasure and dislike pain, but that is really a tautology. And by turning these issues into empirical problems, maximization and the constancy of taste, I think we may gain quite a lot, I think, of in, well, perhaps in laying a foundation for a type of welfare economics that Lord Robbins would have approved of. He did not approve of a standard one. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Kahneman. I hope you're all sitting comfortably after listening to that lecture, and I'm glad you took our minds off the colonoscopy in your concluding remarks. Now, I think we have time for just one or two questions, and I'm sure there are a lot around. Yes.
I think the question that you raised is one that probably the microphone failed. Well, you probably can hear me. Let me turn off this thing. I mentioned the question of who is the relevant self. That is the relevant self the experiencing self or the remembering self? And you know, there is a very substantial issue. I did take the position, I think, that the relevant self ought to be the experiencing self. That is, that if you were making judgments for someone else, on someone else's behalf, I think you probably would want them to have a good experience. And that to the extent that memory would be important, it is the extent to which memory itself is an object of consumption. So that undoubtedly there are experiences, you know, like your daughter's wedding, which are worth having, you know, mainly because of the memory. I mean, so you remember them a lot and you spend a lot of time remembering them. So that's part of real consumption. There are many memories that we don't consume at all. And they're to be guided by remembered utility when it's something that, in fact, it's a memory that you will never consume. I do not quite see the rationale for this. But I agree that I took a strong position on a debatable
Perhaps I could put a question. It strikes me that when you're trying to sum up all the different kinds of utility in your life, you have got a bit of an apples and pears problem. I mean, how can you add up, for example, the pleasure of eating a good meal with the pleasure of perhaps having given birth to a child or written a book? You know, it seems to me that these okay, we might use the word pleasure about all of them, but they're surely experiences which are quite different in kind. And, you know, when you look at different measures of welfare, try to get beyond the old GNP per head, you end up having to simply attach different and rather arbitrary weights to factors like health, education, the amount of food consumed, and so on. Can we really add up these different things?
This is where I think the position that I was taking, this is the science fiction element, I think. We do not have the goods on this yet. But it is fairly clear that there is machinery in the brain that scores ongoing experience. And that scores ongoing experience in a way where various experiences converge on the same activity. There are some brain chemicals that are secreted under pleasurable conditions where the pleasures are of all kinds, very different kinds of pleasures, called the same changes in the relative activity in different brain regions and in the secretion of different brain chemicals. So although it's undoubtedly the picture I drew is a wild oversimplification, it is also the case that I think truth will end up simpler than the enumeration of the richness of human experience might lead us to believe. Advise. Actually, the evidence on that is different, because here we're talking about impression formation. Your first paragraph, I would advise work very hard on your first paragraph. Work very hard on the end, because both of those are likely to be read. About the middle, you know, you never know. We hope that a measure of instant utility that is devised incorporates this. But as I was making the assumption that a good measure of instant utility will incorporate this, so that if you're having an experience of a dish and you are disappointed because you expected more, the measure of instant utility ought to be lower than if you had physically the same experience but you were pleasantly surprised because you hadn't expected less. So we would wish our measure of instant utility to incorporate this. I do not know that we have a measure. All this is quite preliminary. We've made only the first step in what looks like a fairly long journey. But unless we can solve that problem, then this program will not work. We need to be able to solve the problem of the role of expectations. But the way that it ought to be solved is by finding a measure of instant utility that incorporates this role. Yes? Oh, certainly. I mentioned what I think is the case, maybe I believed that before, but I believe it much more strongly now that I've been studying this problem for a while. I think the Friedman's case against paternalism, which is based really on very largely not only on the virtue of choosing, but on the idea that people know what's good for them, I would really remove that part of the argument, because I do not think it can be. It is just not true that people who become addicted to smoking know what's good for them. It's just not true, I think. And in some way, I view this as scandalous. Now, on the other hand, it's quite enough to say that paternalism is bad because freedom is important. So there is a very strong argument against paternalism, which in no way depends on. The answer to that question is undoubtedly yes. That is, people have experienced the same physical states quite differently when they have control over their situation and when they do not. And free choice has both costs and benefits, and that's a long story. We know a fair amount about the cost of freedom and about the benefits of freedom. Nothing to add to that.
Perhaps I can comment as somebody who's had both hips replaced, and I was very glad to have a general anesthetic, and I was not even offered the local anesthetic. I was rather glad. Well, I think on that sort of happy note of pain not remembered, we will close the second lecture and encourage you all to come back to the third lecture tomorrow. And on behalf of the Robbins family, I'm the son-in-law of Lord Robbins, and his daughter, my wife, is here, and his son Richard and his wife, and I think I can say that as non-economists, and perhaps that stands for some of the rest of you, I think these lectures must mean a lot, because they go right to the roots of our daily lives and what we experienced. And I know that I will have a very long memory of these lectures, and well, I've enjoyed them so much that I'm not sure that I could enjoy them even more in memory, but I will try. Thank you.
Thank you very much.